This is the Art Beauty Podcast, where we tell the real truth about the fake shit. I'm Amber, and today my fabulous and gorgeous co-host is Mr. Joseph Panetta. He is the creator of Left of Center Consulting and somebody who you will understand by the end of this podcast, you all want to know. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited too, and I'm just going to cut right to it. So, you know, a lot of the podcasts that I do are with beauty experts. They're with doctors. We're talking about something in particular. And when I was introduced to you, my sister-in-law introduced me to you and just said, hey, here's somebody who has been in the beauty business, who really knows everything about everything. And she wasn't wrong. And when we met and we chatted the first time, I think we were supposed to have like, I don't know, a half hour Zoom. It ended up being hours. Because I was just like, oh my God, this guy knows everything in the best way. And I could just listen to your stories forever. And I was like, let's just come on. So everybody who's listening now, you're going to learn so many great things. This is just going to be one of those podcasts that you're going to be able to go to the next party and pull out this little Panetta gem, is what I will call it, a Joseph gem, if you will. So let's just get into it, because you have this incredible history in beauty. Give us like a couple of the highlights.
Sure. So I've spent more than 30 years, as I like to say, touching every part of a woman's body through communications. I have done hair color, hair care, color cosmetics, skin care, the Botoxes of the world, Wonder Bra, soy menopausal supplements, Dr. Scholl's pedicure essentials, fingernail polish. Am I forgetting anything?
You know what I want to laugh about, or not laugh, I want to tell people, because I got to sit down. We had a fabulous lunch not that long ago. So I touch on a lot of subjects. There's a lot of information that goes on. And a lot of it, honestly, it comes in. I'm really excited about it and it goes out. You, my friend, have managed to retain every interesting bit of information I feel like you've ever learned. And right off the bat, you told me this fabulous story about when you were working at Wonder Bra, which I would love for you to share. Because listen, ladies, if you think right now that like you need to be a skinny mini and that's what it is,
I have news for you. This is why attraction fools us, right? So years ago, Glamour magazine did a study. They lined up women from size 2 to size 20, and almost like a law and order, like perp walk, right? They put men on the other side of the glass. And they asked men, looking at these women, what size do you prefer? And they had their sizes in front of them, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, etc. And, you know, the vast majority of men were, their preferences fell somewhere around a 6'8". And at that time, that was considered the body ideal. That's what they wanted models to be, et cetera. Then they did something super clever. They blindfolded the men and brought them in the room with the women, and they shuffled the women around. And they asked the men to hug the women, right? And then they asked them, which one felt better? Uniformly, a 14, 16 size?
Yeah.
So think about this. The size doubled when they touched them. The feel felt better than the eye taught them they would like. And that was mind-blowing to me. Like, I just thought, wow, women need to know this.
I love this on so many levels. I also laugh because a study like this could never happen today, right? You would never be able to like have random men touching women of all different sizes. Like, unfortunately, I just don't think we could get away with this today. And I'd also be interested, you know, I wonder, do you happen to know, and I hate to say this, but was this like a panel of mostly white men? Or do you think it was all mixed races?
Actually,
at different times.
At that time, I don't know. I don't recall if there was I would believe that they would use a fairly mixed panel, but they would not have focused on the mix as much then as they would now. But we also have to understand that society's gone through a major shift. If we look back, just not even that far, J-Lo and Junk in the Trunk made 8-year-old girls suddenly feel confident about their bodies as they're going through early puberty and they're putting on a little bit of weight, and it made them feel okay about that and own that. And that the sexiest thing a woman or a man can have is confidence.
1,000%. So let me tell you, when I met my husband, I was a good I don't know. I was living with my best friend at this time. We were like in our early, we just turned 30. We were partying. We were boozing. We would come back. We would order like the left side of the diner menu. And when I met my husband, I was fluffier. Let's just put it that way. And I remember one time he said to me, he's like, "You are as beautiful as the day I met you." And I was like, "Take that back." But he was, he was like, "I want my woman to look like a woman." And he always says to me, he's like, "This ideal of like the stick thin model." He's like, "We're not going to make blanket statements here," but he's like, "I think a majority of men don't want that."
When we think about the beauty ideals through time, right? And I'm not talking about going back to like, you know, Van Gogh and Rubin. I'm talking about like 50s, 60s, 70s. Those Marilyn Monroe as a beauty icon, if you look at those photos, she had cellulite.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at...
she supposedly like a size... Was she a 6 or an 8 or was she a 12?
Oh, no, she was a 12.
But a 12 then, you know, we've got vanity sizing now. So I believe that like a 12 then is probably like a Banana Republic.
Maybe, but I think for me, it was all about the proportion. And that's the kind of like the Linda Carter appeal. Like I grew up on Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, and she presented to me the feminine ideal. She was tall and beautiful, the blue eyes, the dark hair. Like that was just like, wow, that is a stunner, right?
But she was tall and thin. She was thin.
But she was also a D cup and she had hips.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
You know, she was not the rail that we see. No.
Well, I feel like the rail really didn't come in until the Kate Moss, right? I mean, she kind of really popularized that like heroin chic look.
Whole heroin chic. But like the thinner and thinner they became, the more they became like hangers. And the truth of the matter is it helped designers with making sample sizes that could go on a runway. And that was more a commercial decision that became a societal impact. And I remember very clearly when I learned that the statues, right? The statues that you see in the Metropolitan Museum or any museum, Greek and Roman men and women, and those perfect physiques, they're gorgeous. I mean, my God, these people, if they lived, they were just amazing. They're not a single person. I come to find out in art class.
This is good.
They are an amalgam of many different people. So a sculptor would actually take like the neck of one woman and add like the shoulders, collarbone, and breast of a second, and then the buttocks of a third. That person that you're looking at was the, you know, 900 BC representation of what we see in Self magazine of being completely retouched.
Right, right, right. Such a good point. You know, it's funny too, because I was in Athens and I remember sort of walking through a lot of the museums there. And you do have, what I did notice was back then though, the women were more voluptuous, right? So the statues, right? Because I guess that was something that showed health. And if you had money, I'm assuming, to have a statue created of you, it meant that you were able to eat and therefore probably carried a little bit more.
And it's why you were not tan. Tan people were people who worked outside. I mean, society has dictated all this stuff, and it kind of like goes into the notion of how we look at skincare today. And I've spent 30 years in skincare and, have done a good deal of research into the history of ingredients specifically. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. The first archaeological evidence of skincare recipes dates back 6,000 years in two locations, China and Egypt. Now, this is where they turned to nature for skincare. So for example, skin scrub that we use today, they use sand, Dead Sea salt, and aloe vera. You think wrinkle cream is new? They were mixing castor oil and moringa seeds. You think what they used for pimples, because pimples have been around since skin has been around, they used frankincense because it's a natural anti-inflammatory.
Oh, wow.
You think the masks that we use today and lay back in the tub are new? Oh, no. They were mixing honey because of its natural antibiotic properties. It's nature's Neosporin. They're mixing honey and milk into a paste and applying it. Now, the Greeks sped that forward by taking fresh fruit and actually mulching it with milk and honey and applying it to the face. It is a topical vitamin C in the real sense of the word.
Sure.
They were using, for dark spot correction, lemon juice, puffy eyes. This is my favorite. in the Renaissance era, women addressed puffy eyes because they woke up after having drunk too much wine and they had those puffy eyes. Day-old bread soaked in rose water.
Oh.
Right?
I wonder why the bread, just because it was like sort of the equivalent of like something spongy?
Probably. You know, and then you've got like a, from an astringent perspective, you would use wine from vinegar, but toner was apple cider vinegar. So they were literally like parsing the ingredients like this, which is hilarious that the cold cream, the pons of the Elizabethan era was rose water, beeswax, and rose oil.
Do you sometimes wonder though, I feel like when you go again, looking back at so many different artists and walking through a museum, when you see things, you know, from like the Elizabethan era, they do all have that beautiful porcelain skin, but I really want that, I mean, I feel like the artists will be accurate in showing like when men had like that redness around the nose and, you know, they weren't all stunningly beautiful, but the skin seemed pretty good. I wonder if the skin was better during that time.
I would think
not, right?
I think not. I think not because I don't think that
they couldn't bathe. Yeah. Right?
And like the first rule of skincare is clean. So, and that's why the wigs, that's why the powder, the immense powder. I mean, Queen Elizabeth was well known to have had blackened teeth because of what she ate. It wasn't because of cavities. It's because she liked a very specific berry that literally stained her teeth.
Blackened your teeth. Can you imagine how disgusting it must have smelled back then? So my boiler broke and I was not without hot water for an entire week. And I remember, you know, I had to heat up a pot of water, you get in the shower and kind of do this thing. And I thought, I would not trade modern day showers and my little baby apartment for all the mirrored hallways in the world. Like, nope, I don't care how much money you have. Plumbing is like, yes.
Right? Exactly. That's the first rule of housekeeping is plumbing.
Right? In so many different ways.
They're true.
Wait, you had a super fun, I'm trying to think, like, because again, I feel like you would be like the ultimate person to bring to a party. You must just pull out these wonderful sort of tidbits. And I love, you were telling me a story about lipstick and then we can continue on with the ingredients.
Absolutely. So like Dr. Kathy Pice at the University of Albany came out with a book a number of years ago called Making Faces, The History of Cosmetics in America. And this is my favorite point. The very first lipstick ever launched in America was one shade sold under two names, Lady and Hussy. Because it all depended on which one you wanted to be.
I love that. Who was the company? Do you know?
It was probably an early version of what ultimately became Unilever, because there were a lot of companies producing skincare at that time. Oh, here's a fun sidestep for you. Do you know where nail polish came from?
No.
Ford Motor Paint.
Really? I think I'm so surprised about is that nail polish wasn't invented until Ford was painting cars and making cars. What was that, the turn of the century, 1800s?
No, you're talking more like the 20s, the late 20s, early 30s.
Okay, but like that's when Ford started making cars, correct? Like the late 1800s, well, turn of the century.
Yeah, when they started doing any color other than black. And they tried a number of colors that didn't work. And one of them didn't work because it chipped when it was impacted. And that is how it was a happy accident that it suddenly becomes fingernail polish.
Oh, thank you, Ford, for so many reasons. that is so, so good. So I know that we do have this incredible, you know, history of beauty and beauty ingredients and many that we're, you know, starting to see come back more and more, right?
We took that pendulum, right, from nature into science around, call it like the nuclear age. So around the 40s, 50s. Now, keep in mind, the FDA came into existence in 1906 because some of those chemicals were finding themselves, those bleaching agents and medicines and metals, the belladonnas of the world, were finding themselves into cosmetics and skincare. And the FDA was created to put controls on those claims. And then in the 40s and 50s, in the nuclear age, it was better living through chemistry. Everybody walked away from nature. It was, if it didn't come out of a beaker, it couldn't really work that well, right?
Correct.
And so that everything was better living through chemicals. And then, of course, like any pendulum, you swing back. The 80s, we saw alpha hydroxy acid. And in the beginning, alpha hydroxy acid, which, by the way, the first recorded use of alpha hydroxy acid is Cleopatra. She would scoop the bottom of a wine barrel and take the residue and apply it to her face to slough off the makeup and skin cells.
Oh, love her. Okay.
Right?
It's good enough for Cleopatra. Yeah. It's good enough for all of us.
Right, amazing. Exactly.
And I know what I'm going to do after like a late night of partying.
Exactly. And I had the opportunity to launch the first mass available AHA in Ponds back in like the early 90s. And then you start getting into another natural ingredient, a form of vitamin A called retinol.
And retinol, I mean, hello. Yes.
There has never been anything like it, won't be anything like it. And it is a natural ingredient that science has empowered. So there's right. this meeting now between the natural ingredients and the way science can transform them. Then obviously after Retin-A, you had this like rebirth in the vitamins. You had vitamin E and vitamin C. You can't swing a cat without hitting a topical vitamin C for good reason.
Yes.
It is a great dark spot remover, anti-age, like it's topical vitamin C is on the top of every derm and plastic surgeon's list, period.
Everybody. I mean, it's something that our bodies can't make itself. So we have to get it externally.
Exactly. And then you've got like some of the new stuff, like there are some antioxidants that are now replacing hormonal and steroidal components in topical creams. CBD has been a top skincare ingredient Huge. For a while. And, you know, there are experts like Dr. Perricone out there who are saying that aging is a disease of inflammation. Right. And of the some 110 cannabinoids in the plant. Now, keep in mind, marijuana makes dope. Hemp makes rope. And CBD right. comes from hemp. THC comes from marijuana. So that's...
Can't you also get marijuana... because there is some CBD with THC. Am I getting them confused?
No. Sometimes people mix THC with CBD. That doesn't mean they come from the same source.
Got it.
Because
All CBD comes from hemp.
All federally legal CBD comes from hemp.
Thank you. Okay.
If you think about like topically applied CBD, the reason why they're saying put it on your skin is because every single FDA clinical that you can read on their website shows us that topically applied CBD has greatest bioavailability and works where you put it. So it's basically the anti-inflammation you want on your face because it actually solves the inflammation.
You know what's really interesting? So I work with New Beauty Magazine, and they, one of our beauty editors just wrote a story on this on newbeauty.com. Right now, there is a company, I think it's not Radical Science, forgive me. They are doing the biggest study of the effects of topical CBD on skincare. So all of you skeptics out there, just know that this is in progress right now. And actually, sometime mid-October, the results are supposed to come out. So this is one of the biggest studies that's been done to date on the effectiveness of CBD topically.
I'm very interested in hearing about this. I advise a company called California Skin Secrets, and they are building a dark spot correction application that actually rivals hydroquinone, and it's built on CBD. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Watch this space. We have this whole like natural ingredient, scientific ingredient, the meeting of the two, and the obvious next step are the devices, right? So we've got lasers with Fraxel, we've got radio frequency with Thermage, we've got ultrasound with Ulthera, and then you've got intense pulse light. And these things, these tools and devices are being used in derm offices and plastic surgery offices, and they're for that really deep refresh, and they're really, really good at anti-aging.
Right.
What's also interesting is this year's Cosmoprof saw more at-home devices than any year prior.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not super surprised about that, but I do also think it's because the at-home devices are getting better, right? So I remember, 15 years ago or so, there was an at-home hair IPL, and it's not that it didn't work, but I think that you had to understand, have reasonable expectations of what this at-home device was going to do. And I think that still stands today, right? So if you want superpowered, it's not that these at-home devices aren't effective. It's not that they're not going to work. They're just not going to be able to work as fast as the ones that are being done in office under medical supervision. And I think we all understand for a reason.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's where we've become very impatient as a society, because we really want a kind of one and done. And what you're talking about is compliance. And that's the biggest bugaboo for any dermoplastic surgeon who has a patient when they kind of want an instant fix. your skin regenerates every 28 days, right? So at a minimum, it's going to take 28 days for you to see results. You don't get, I mean, this notion of overnight is
a lie.
Almost over, right? It's not reality. And that's where the new frontier, the new next, and that's this stuff, right? Artificial intelligence. We have about 7 to 9 apps on the market today that use machine learning to basically promote a specific brand's, you know, cosmetics or skincare. It's almost like a matching device on your phone, which is great if you don't know which foundation color to use, right? Though I advise a company called Cutis.ai, and they are the largest app ever mounted on the App Store. That's a big claim because it's a big data thing. And what they're, when they're eventually launched, you will scan your face using the phone on your camera, and an AI will deliver to you a treatment plan based on the 93% accuracy of what it reads on your face. Rosacea, acne, you know, melasma, dark circles, et cetera. And it will prescribe for you, like, for example, if you have acne, right? And you scan your face and it tells you to scan it 3 different ways. So it gets an accurate picture. And then the AI runs and it says, right, you have acne in these areas. You need a benzoyl peroxide concentration of 8% or better. Here are some options for you. And then the AI prompts you with push notifications to remind you to use it. So it goes back to the compliance thing.
Because it's only as good as your routine. You can have thousands of dollars worth of products, but if they're just sitting on your bathroom shelf.
Exactly. And then the other part is this AI is so sensitive that the more often you scan your face, the more it knows about your face. So it'll say, you're about 3 weeks away from your Botox needing to be re-upped. Or like my favorite story is if you are a 16-year-old girl suffering with acne, right? And you're scanning your face, it will know when your cycle is coming because your acne is getting worse and the medication isn't working. So it'll tell you to up it.
I mean, you know, I really embrace technology. My father, I've got, a Google back there. If I say it too loud, it's going to start talking to us. I've got them all throughout the house. I ask it questions all the time. But I guess in some ways it is a little bit sort of jarring how much information about us is out there and accessible. And listen, on one hand, I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to go with it because it does make your life better. But cycle prediction from my phone, I mean, actually, I already do that. I've got an app that's been tracking my cycle for years. So, hey, I'm all for it. Do we know anything about this Cutis AI? Do we know when it's going to launch?
Cutis.ai will probably be out first of next year. And there's a consumer version, and obviously it's not meant to replace a physician or an esthetician by any stretch. It actually puts you in touch with one for a prepaid consult. So it's looking how to bring the consumer and their advisor, their coach, their skin coach, on this journey to get them where they want to go. And the thing that I really like about it is the compliance driver and the fact that it can detect changes. There's so many security and safety protocols, it actually outweighs the NSA in terms of what it won't share, because this is valuable for the user, not the internet, right? But you know,
when you get something. And listen, anybody who has an iPhone right now, your face has been mapped. I mean, so hello, that's just
your voice,
that's where we're living in. Everything, you know, it's funny. I remember a while ago, you know, people were like, I swear my phone's listening to you. Well, my girlfriend went to go work for Ericsson and she was like, yeah, no, actually my job is to purchase the keywords that your phone technology is listening for. So I don't think anybody thinks it's a secret anymore, but yes, everything actually is listening to you. Have you heard of the device? And I don't want to like throw you off because, you know, I'm not sure that you do. There is, and I can't think of the name of it right now. There is something, it's a device on the market. And essentially what it does is it is like a tiny little inkjet printer, and it will, you run it over your face and it gets rid of discoloration. How it gets rid of discoloration is that it will sense discoloration when it's going over your face. And literally it is putting micro droplets of foundation so that you don't have to wear foundation everywhere. Now it will just run over your face, and if it sees a little dark spot, it shoots out the sort of like an inkjet printer and covers up only those spots.
I am fascinated.
Okay.
But I'll tell you what, I bet you that came out of Korea, because those folks walk around looking like they're wearing an Instagram filter all the time. It's amazing. They always look like they have perfect skin.
Well, you know what? I saw a woman today. No, my mother's Korean, but I saw a woman today who was Asian. That's fair to say now. But umbrella, and you see a lot of Asian women walking around with umbrellas. They are very, very, very serious about sun protection. And most of like the super duper like invisible sunscreens came from Korea and Asian beauty.
Correct. And by the way, they're also often wearing gloves, if you'll notice.
I know. Well, because hey, like the thing that shows our hands is, I'm trying to look, what was the inkjet printer for your face? All right. Opti. And it was made by P&G. It's called Opti. It was made by P&G. And essentially it says tiny cameras that take photos at 200 frames a second. It's going to give you targeted, essentially, coverage on your skin. Now, I know that one of the beauty editors reviewed it and she was like, yes, it's very cool. But it's not inexpensive. I think it's like
$60. No, but I mean, wow, that's really interesting.
Yes. Very, very interesting. I mean, so where do you think, you know, you've been through so many evolutions of beauty. Where do you think we're headed?
You know, that's a really potent question. And just looking, the research that I've done and life, right? You know, when you've been working in the industry for more than three decades, what I have seen is that there is a push against the ideal, right? Mm-hmm. To the real. So Plato once said, we cannot achieve the ideal because we live in the real. And I share that to say this, look at the Dove Real Beauty campaign, the breakthrough that was. And there was a, by the way, French director of the brand in America who allowed his agency the room to do this, because obviously French aren't necessarily all about not doing perfection. And that was not the beginning. That was the tipping point. The beginning happened earlier than that if we were paying attention. If we look back at history and those J-Lo and Junk in the Trunk and that sort of like be okay with how you are, who you are, et cetera. Real beauty and the way that they have evolved it has now taken root throughout. We have plus size and gender neutral CoverGirl models. So the idea of multiculturalism in beauty, natural hair in the African-American community, the, you know, every shade under the sun for Band-Aids, right? We're getting there. It's the last frontier to get us there. But ultimately, we will be looking at beauty standards that are no longer singular. They are expansive.
You know, I just did a wonderful podcast with Cosabella, and one of the things that blew me away that I found at Trattin, Cosabella, who is a very famous Italian-inspired luxury lingerie brand, is now opening, they're working on inclusive sizing for men who are wearing, you know, for transgendered men, for men who just want to wear a beautiful lace thong, but they were like, we realized that a big part of our, so the bralettes, they were like, a bralette for a man is not going to be the same even for a bralette as a very flat-chested woman. It's going to need different support. And so I just loved that they were working on this and that we're seeing that, you know, so that it's not just, okay, here's all of the sizes, but it's like, here's all of the sizes and the genders and the colors and all of the good stuff in between.
I firmly believe that inclusivity is the new black, basically. Yeah. It's going to be the thing. Everyone is going to pony up and need to, because that's what the consumer is going to look for.
Right. Right. I mean, it's just crazy to think that when, you know, you look back at like the 60s and all of the women had very similar, gorgeous hairstyles. And now it's so incredibly different. You know, when we say what the beauty standard is, it's just you're saying that there's going to be no standard because it's going to be so individual.
Exactly. I think the beauty standard is an individual standard because it's about what makes me feel confident in my skin today. And that goes to what I put on my face, to how I wear my hair, to what I put on my body, to how I decide to show up in the world. And so I don't believe that people change who they are, but I do believe that people change how they are who they are.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that. You know, before we let you go, I'm wondering if we can just, Well, I'm just going to share it because you were the director of public relations for a woman that
Elizabeth Taylor.
Some of us know you. Okay. Elizabeth Taylor, big deal. You know, and I think that she, you shared, you actually were, did this documentary and I learned so many fabulous things about her and what an incredible woman she was. And I'm just wondering if you can share the story about the ring. That's so fun.
Of course. Of course. So, I mean, it's one story that Elizabeth shared frequently because it would literally make her light up with laughter when she remembered it. So during her marriage to Richard Burton, one of two to Richard Burton, you know, he followed alongside many of her other earlier husbands who awarded her lots of beautiful pieces of jewelry. This piece was originally a Cartier diamond that was later renamed the Taylor Burton diamond. And it was 36.2 carats. It was like a giant teardrop ice cube. And yes, it had a fastener on the back so that it could be a ring or it could be a brooch. Shortly after receiving it, she attends a dinner in London. At the table, she was sat with Princess Margaret and a bunch of other people. And these women were oohing and aahing over this ring and she was passing it around and people were trying it on. And Princess Margaret just sort of looks over and says, "It's perfectly vulgar." And Elizabeth said to her, "You know, you're right. Would you like to try it on?" And so she takes the ring and she slides it on the princess's finger and the princess begins to look at her hand and Elizabeth leans into her ear and says, "It's not so vulgar now, is it?"
And I love that because you know, she was like, oh, hello, how you doing? Yeah.
And what Elizabeth was doing was like, "Girl, I called you out." But yeah. You know, and that was just part and parcel of the personality of Elizabeth Taylor. And there, you know, there was, the thing that I liked the most about being involved in that documentary was the narrative approach that they took was one about how this woman took control of her life and lived her life on her own terms, or what many of the women cited in the documentary as being a man's terms in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, through the studio
system. Well, and interesting, where Hollywood controlled your entire life from who you met, who you married, who you spent time with, the way that your hair looked, the way that, I mean, they controlled everything.
Every aspect. In fact, they would actually control the, if you bought a house, your entire house would be outfitted by the prop department. And so you could come home and discover that your entire dining room was gone because they needed it for a shoot. If you're holding, and this happened, if you're holding a dinner, right? You call the prop department. You're like, "You took my dining room. I'm having a dinner at 8. The prop department would deliver another dining room complete with the silverware, the chandelier, the grand piano, like all that stuff, move it in, set it up so you could have your dinner party. But the whole point was they owned it. The only thing they allowed her to own was her car.
I love that you know. See, this is why I'm obsessed with you. Everybody who's listening right now, couldn't you just hang out with him forever? Because like, what an incredible thing. I knew that the studio controlled it. I had no idea that the prop department would not only set up everything in your house, but they would take it away if they needed it for a shoot.
And didn't ask permission.
No. I mean, you know, part of me though is kind of like, if somebody wanted to come in and redesign my house, I don't need to be that attached to the stuff. But yes, if you're having a dinner party, I guess you have to call and check in and say, "Hey, I guess what, I kind of, any my dish is back."
Indeed, indeed. And like, I'll share one other Elizabeth story with you that was really potent and powerful and hilarious. There was a lot of, like, it was the shot heard around the world when she was paid $1 million to play Cleopatra. Right.
And so the highest paid actress ever, right?
The highest paid actor in the world up to that point.
Not just actress, actor.
It was 8 times what she had been paid for her last film.
Wow.
And mind you,
and more than any man at that time, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So this is how that story went down, which is hilarious. She's in the bathtub and Daryl Zanuck is on the phone from Fox and he wants her to be Cleopatra and she does not want to play it. She does not want to do it. It's going to be filmed in Egypt. It's exhausting. It's long. I don't want to do it. And so she's telling Roddy McDowell, her friend, who's on the other side of the bathroom door and translating over the phone, like, you know, by the way, this was like the 8th phone call and she's in the tub. And so she finally shoots over her shoulder. She goes, "Tell him I'll do it for $1 million. Pause. Roddy yells through, "He said, okay, for $1 million. And Elizabeth was like, "I never thought they would say yes to that." And she said, "I just opened my mouth and fell under the tub, under water in the tub, because I thought well, crap, they called my bluff. I have to do it now. And so then she owned it. Then she was like, yes, yes, I did demand $1 million and I should be paid $1 million. Like, so that sarcastic comment from a tub became the thing that made her the headlines all around the world. And by the way, that narrative of her taking control of her life and living her life on her terms is incredibly relevant to today's millennials and Gen Z, because they see that there were pioneers and forerunners who were actually blazing the trail that they are now on.
Yes. And like a little bit of business advice that came from my daddy when I learned it very young. When you go in to negotiate, aim high, say it once, and then shut up. Because you never know when they're like, yeah, okay. And especially if it's a job that you don't want to do, double that number that you think is so disgustingly, like, you're like, they'll never go for this, because guess what? Sometimes they will.
Yeah, I heard a similar anecdote.
You don't hate the job as much.
Well, exactly. And you just keep going up until you start to laugh.
Right.
When you start to laugh, you've gone too high. But until then, no, not too high.
Not too high. Oh my gosh, you have such wonderful, wonderful stories. And I do want to say that now, through all of this incredible background, and I think it's clear that you have touched every aspect of beauty, you are a true connoisseur, you have come up with your own line, Molecule. Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. So Molecule is a result of the marriage of science powering natural ingredients. So we used an emerging science in the quantum field to change the electron spin around natural molecules. So it only works on natural ingredients. It won't work on house paint, for example. So on we powered our vitamin A so that it's actually 140% more powerful as retin A. Our vitamin C is 118% more potent, and our growth factor is 141% more powerful as a result of the exposure to this technology. And Molecule, and it's M-O-L-E-Q-U-L-E, sold on Amazon. It's eye patches and masks. Leave it on for about 8 to 10 minutes. If you don't see results, your money back. Everybody who has tried this has been like, holy crap. And you'll say, oh wait, the ingredients look the same. Yes, no. And no. The ingredients are similar. The application of the science to different ingredients in different packages renders different effects.
Effects. Let me just tell you, it was a lifesaver for me. I was visiting you in California and went out and overindulged a little. Let's just put it that way one night. And the next morning, bop, 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 life saving. And also very, very an affordable luxury. Very
yes,
affordable. What do they go
that was
for?
The whole point.
What it's sold on Amazon? Is it sold on Amazon right now if people want to look into this?
Correct. It's sold on Amazon. Okay. It's a pack of three masks is $24.99 and a pack of three under eye patches is $17.99.
I mean, trust me on this. And you said money back guarantee.
Yep.
I mean, you can't deliver better than that. And I hope that everybody listening understands now how much information, how much access you've had to really formulate the best of the best. I'm obsessed with you. If people want to know more about Molecule, where do they go first? Let's direct to them.
MoleculeSkincare.com, M-O-L-E-Q-U-L-E skincare.com.
Okay. And now I don't want to put you on the spot, but if everybody wants to like just get you in their lives immediately, where's the best place to find you?
You know, reach out to me on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me at locc.me. So it's Left of Center Consulting, locc.me, as in it's all about me. And I am happy to respond to you. Like, call me, email me. I'm always happy to talk.
I love that. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I know, obsessed, obsessed, obsessed. If you have any questions you want me to pass on to Joseph, always happy to do that. You can email me at hello@rpdpodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and here on YouTube at RPD Podcast. And as always, we will see you next Tuesday.
Looking forward to it. Cheers.
Bye.